Well, now we will turn to our guest, Dr. Suzanne Trupin. Hi, glad to have you here. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has a practice in our area. She is on faculty of the U of I Med School. And every other month now, it's almost on a Monday, she is here, and we take questions on women's health. And it's also an opportunity for her to talk a little bit about things that are new, sometimes things that are in the news. And it's also a chance for you to call with questions. One thing I always caution when we have physicians on the program is that we have some limits as to what we can do because the doctor can't see you. But it's a good place to get some basic information. So if you have questions, please do give us a call, and she will do her best to help you out. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. So you always come prepared with a few things to talk about.
And it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, October, again. And so I'd like to talk about aspects of breast cancer prevention and diagnosis. And there are a few new things out there that people may not know about. Actually, our American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists point out that about 70% of young women actually find their own breast cancer by checking their body, and that women who are older find about 50% of the breast cancers that we find, but not necessarily through the regular self-breast examinations that we've talked about in the past. Mm-hmm. And so they've switched the focus from a regular self-breast exam to just becoming more aware, more familiar with your own breasts. So what does the skin normally look like? What does it feel like? New discomforts, new irritations, yes, some new change in texture or a mass, and maybe a lump under your arm, something like that. And then when you do discover one of these changes, getting in to see your provider and confirming if this is a worrisome change or something not so worrisome that can be treated. So it's moved away from breast self-exam, but not away from breast awareness. So it is a little bit of a different focus, not necessarily just doing that regular monthly exam that we used to talk about in the past. So it has changed a little bit. And we also want to talk to women about the actual preventable causes of breast cancer. So we think that breast cancer has something to do with estrogen exposure because people who have an early puberty, people who have a very late menopause, so go through many extra years of estrogen exposure, do have a little bit higher risk. Women who have a baby later in life, women who do not breastfeed, they have a greater risk. But also women who smoke, women who drink alcohol, and women who are overweight have greater risks. And we think that if you cut back on alcohol intake, normalize your weight, exercise, cut back on that smoking, actually, those are preventable cases of breast cancer. And we've talked about some of the relationships, but we haven't really tried to focus to our patients that this is a way of preventing the cancer from ever coming about. And also we think that probably one in five individuals has a link with a genetic focus. And we think that of those women, if we can identify what the link is and take prevention strategies, so the most common prevention strategy that we would talk to people about is using medicine. So using tamoxifen, you can use the medicine Avista. So if you have a genetic link and you actually go on one of these medications to prevent breast cancer, there are more radical means of preventing breast cancer. You can actually have a risk-reducing surgery, which obviously removes the breast in at-risk people. But if you just even take the tamoxifen for 5 years, if you are somebody that should take it, that could prevent over 50% of the cases of estrogen-dependent breast cancers in those at-risk people. So preventable causes of breast cancer. We also now think that our strategies for doing mammograms still very important. And we talk a little bit, you know, now and then, who to do a mammogram on, how often to do a mammogram, And I always remind patients that doing that mammogram is it's a strategy of identifying an extremely early cancer. And if we do find a cancer on mammography, there's at least a 98% chance that you're going to outlive that breast cancer because they find it so early in most cases. And the Hologic company has now actually improved their mammograms. As far as I know, we don't have access to this yet in our actual community. And I tried to look online at their website, and I couldn't even identify anything that was actually close. But there is a new 3D mammogram that has been developed that should pick up about 7% more cases. So it's even more precise. And yet the caveat, it's always on the one hand, on the other hand. I know comedians do it better. But the caveat is that it is more radiation because it's a mammogram is an X-ray. It is done with radiation. And some people may, in fact, be radiation sensitive. We haven't really established exactly what levels of radiation are safe versus unsafe. We get exposed to radiation just when we walk outside. There's UV radiation all around us. But it would increase your exposure to radiation. And these machines are certainly not available everywhere. But it may be one of those game-changing type of tests that soon everybody will. You know, we moved from what we call film screen mammography, where they were processed on the sheets with silver, to digital images a few years back. And it took a while to have all of our mammogram centers in the town equipped with digital, which they are now. But now this is the next step, is the 3D. And because it was just relatively newly FDA approved, it's too soon to say whether our institutions will move towards that or not.
Well, I know this is something we've talked about a lot over the years, and we have all talked about other kinds of technologies that are not X-rays, and I'm sure that there are some women who would say, well, it's can be kind of uncomfortable having a mammogram. They're concerned about the X-ray exposure. Some women, their breasts are kind of dense, and that mammogram doesn't really give you the kind of view that you would like, and there are other things that you could do, like ultrasound, for example, that I imagine some people would say, for a variety of reasons, would be better. But now still, I'm sure that probably most women, when they're having screening for breast cancer, what they're having, they're still having mammograms. Is
Correct.
It likely that's going to change?
Well, there's thermography still, and there are still a number of thermogram machines out there, but we just don't think they're specific enough. Ultrasound, we usually view as hand-in-hand with mammograms. Ultrasound is a little bit better than X-ray at picking up a fluid-filled structure, but picking up a solid structure and really establishing the nature of the type of calcifications, we still think mammography is better. There are some women that just won't get a mammogram. So in my patients that just won't get a mammogram, if they're willing to do an ultrasound, it's definitely better than only a breast exam. And I think that we can also look at the issue of getting an MRI or a magnetic resonance image. And the problem with MRI is that it's just going to identify so many more potentially suspicious areas that the cost is quite prohibitive. The number of biopsies is prohibitive. There are some areas of the country that won't read your MRI unless they also have a mammogram to compare it to. So you're not saving yourself radiation. You're still getting a mammogram, just getting this extra test. And for somebody that has had previous cancers or has another reason to get an MRI, I think it's very, very important. And we're still hoping to be able, like with cervical cancer, we don't diagnose very many cervical cancers. We diagnose precancers and we treat them. And we still have not quite moved to that in breast detection. And the only test we have is a Halo breast pap test. And women come in and it's essentially like a medical grade breast pump and takes about 5 minutes. Most patients say it's uncomfortable on the level of 2 to 3. out of 10 pain-wise, so a little discomfort. And then we look for whether the breasts are having a slight bit of discharge, or and if that discharge has cells, and if those cells are in fact precancerous. And then we can additionally identify, not just use your family history, but actually figure out what's going on in the breast to identify people who might benefit from prevention, or a group of people that really needs to come off their birth control hormones, something like that. So that's, again, not a test that replaces mammogram per se, although you can do the Halo breast pap as young as 25. And we don't, even in the earliest cases, we don't really start mammograms till about 40. Unless you had a family member that had a breast cancer, in which case you should be getting your mammogram about 10 years before anyone in your family. So if you had a family member that got a breast cancer at 38, yes, at 28, you're supposed to get your first mammogram. Mm-hmm. So it does vary. But most people are getting breast cancer after the age of menopause. So age 40 is still a good time to start for the vast majority of people. But you're right. Trying to do other tests has always been attractive because of that somewhat discomfort level.
Yeah. Our questions are welcome. I just wanted to mention again, our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's on the program every other month here. It's always on a Monday when she is here, and we talk about women's health. And if you have questions on this particular subject, if you want to talk about breast cancer or anything else, the kinds of things that she deals with in her practice, call us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can also email at will-talk@illinois.edu. And anything else that in terms of prevention, particularly for people who know that they're in a high-risk category?
So I've pretty much covered the basic strategies. Of course, you talk to your own physician and really find out if you have risk or not. Mm-hmm. The easiest way, there are many different mathematical models that we use to predict risk. And the easiest one to use is called the Gail Scale, G-A-I-L. And you can Google it. It's available on the National Cancer Institute website, but lots of other places have access to that tool. There are a couple of different variations on that tool. They basically are focused on whether or not you had a first-degree relative that had breast cancer. They're focused on whether you've had children, how old you were when you had children, and whether you've had a biopsy and if that biopsy, in fact, was normal or abnormal. And they give you a statistical calculation of your percent chance of having a breast cancer in the next 5 years and your lifetime percent chance. And then based on those statistics, we talk about who might be a candidate for things like tamoxifen therapy or Avista therapy, which is raloxifene, which also helps to prevent menopausal bone loss. So it has a double benefit if you go with the Avista. And so I think that really using one of these tools to predict your risk. Now, because that particular mathematical calculation uses moms, daughters, and sisters, there are a couple of other scales out there that use, say, your dad's side, or if you're somebody that has, maybe you didn't even have any sisters and you haven't even had any kids, and your mom didn't happen to have breast cancer, but all her aunts and bunch of, you know, a couple of grandmas, then or related cancers, then they use those scores to calculate your risk. So without even necessarily being blood tested for the breast cancer genes 1 and 2, the BRCA 1 and 2, you can figure out your Gail scale score, and then based on that score, go in and talk to your physician about whether you'd be somebody for any kind of treatment that would reduce that risk.
Okay. You know, just recently there has been, well, I guess not maybe, it's not exactly recent, although there has been a little uptick now in reporting about prostate cancer. Although for some time now, there has been some controversy over the blood test, which generally has been recommended for men over 50 to test for the possibility that they would have cancer. Of course, the thing about this test is that it doesn't necessarily say that you have cancer. It says something going on with your prostate. But if you, you know, if you get a high reading on this, then what you have to do is say, okay, now we got to find out what's going on. And you end up having biopsies. And then there's questions about, based on that result, you know, what do you do? And the concern is that if we did a random survey of men who died and we looked at their prostate, we would find a lot of guys who had prostate cancer who did not die of it. So then the question is, well, okay, how do you think about who you treat and who you don't? And the big problem is that now we don't have a good way of distinguishing between the prostate cancers that will kill you and the prostate cancers that won't. And that's an ongoing, you know, conversation with urologists and people who specialize in dealing with that. Is there anything like that kind of parallel issue when you're talking about breast cancer?
Oh, absolutely. And that's where the controversy has come in as to when you stop your mammograms. So many doctors will tell you, as long as you are young enough, quote unquote, and healthy enough to do something about this breast cancer that is found, then yes, have a mammogram and act on the results. Now, if you have an actual mass or an actual breast symptom, that's a different issue. So that for some physicians, there is no upper age limit as to when you should stop your mammograms. For other physicians and the United States Preventive Health Task Force, they said you could stop mammograms at age 75. Now, 75 seems a little young to many of us.
Well, given how long people now live, yeah.
Exactly. So, but again, let's talk about a woman in her 90s or late 90s. Because breast cancer has such a long lag period of time, and that even when we find it on mammogram, it probably has been in our bodies for 8 to 10 years. And even when we find it on exam, and you've got a little grape there, mm-hmm. it's probably already been in your body 12 to 14 years. So if you identify something that is still going to be a localized mass in 3 to 4 years, and you're 99, is that going to change things? Because by the time it's a mass, you can still remove the mass and you still get a good cure rate from treating it at that stage. So that's the controversy, and it's pretty analogous to what's going on in the prostate world. Mm.
Our guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Truppin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's on the program every other month on the show, and she is one of a group of people who have been a part of Focus for about as long as there has been Focus, and that's been 30 years.
Now, David, they know I didn't go to medical school at 3.
So she's been very generous with her time. We have shows like this on the station to give you the chance to ask questions and get some answers. And we do these on a regular basis, and we do a lot of other programs as well. You know, we talk about politics and social issues and science and history, lots of different sorts of things on the program. We're here with two different topics, two different guests every weekday. And we've been doing that for now for 30 years. And I am happy that one of the features for me about this program is that I get this wonderful, long, unbroken opportunity to have a conversation with somebody. If this was a commercial radio station, that would not be happening because about every 5 minutes I'd have to stop and take a break. I don't have to do that because people like you who are listening, support the station with your dollars. It's a non-commercial, non-profit public station, but that only works when listeners do support the station, meaning that you give us some money to help pay the bills. This is one time, just a couple of times we sit here in front of the microphone to do this. The rest of the time we do the show, which is what I would want to be doing. But I'm also happy to have an opportunity to say, hey, folks, now's the time. Step up and be counted. And we have some people, you know, like Suzanne, she's been involved in this show for a long time. Well, we have listeners who have been involved in this station for a long time, who have been giving us their support for a long, long time. We want to say thanks to them, but we can't just do it with them. We need to grow the listener base every day, every year. We need to get some more folks in. So if you're not a supporter, we hope that you will do that. We're hoping by the end of our fall fundraising effort, and that's tomorrow evening, we will have heard from 1,200 people, and you can be the next. All you have to do is call 217-244-9455, or you can go online to willpledge.org. Either way you do it, your support is very important to the station. We have a caller here, someone who's been very patient, and we'll get with them right now. Someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a very specific question. This has to do with treatment for osteoporosis. I had, after some time, a bad reaction with Fosamax with, GERD, and so I had to quit taking it. That was many years ago, and I've been using Evista and calcium, of course, and D. But now I'm advised that maybe I should be taking something called, I believe, Atelvia, which is a time-released and is supposed not to involve your upper GI system. Can you tell me about this?
So Atelvia is a very interesting compound. I was actually in one of the research studies on it. And essentially, Fosamax is... And so is Atelvia. It's a bisphosphonate. And bisphosphonates have very poor absorption. You probably only get 1% of the medicine. So it's very critical that you are able to absorb it correctly. And that is why with the medications like Fosamax and some of the cousin medications, the Beneva and the Actonel, it was a precaution to take it on an empty stomach with a full glass of water and not eat or drink for a certain time period, depending on which one you have. And because the molecule itself is a little bit irritating to the lining of the stomach and could be to the lining of the esophagus. So for listeners who maybe don't know those fancy initials for GERD, it has to do with some of the stomach fluid refluxing back into the lower esophagus. And if that occurs with medication in it, it can irritate the lower part of the esophagus as well. So there have been some strategies for people to take the bisphosphonates more effectively because we get that low dose anyway. We only get 1%. If absorption is working correctly, we don't get very much absorbed. So it has to work correctly, or we don't get any absorbed. So that's critical. And so what they did with the medication, the Atelvia that you're asking about, is they developed it as an intestinal release. So the pill, if you will stay inert until into your intestine, and it'll pass past the stomach without releasing its medication, get into your intestine where it then will release the medication. So even if you still have GERD, which people who have GERD will have GERD, and some of the stomach fluids will wash back, but it's certainly not going to upset the stomach near as much. Now, anything, certain individuals, anything that you eat or take in can upset your stomach to some extent. And so there are ways to even bypass the entire intestinal tract, such as the medication Reclast, which can be given intravenously once a year, medicine Beneva, which can be given intravenously once a year. And now we have the medication Prolia, which can be a sub-Q. And the other nice thing about either Actonel or the Atelvia formulation of it is that it has very good hip fracture prevention data. So depending on what is going on with your case, and not everybody needs to stay on these bisphosphonates indefinitely, 5 and 10 year courses within a break are recommended by some physicians in some cases. So you've had a break off of that medicine. So there are a number of considerations. We can't treat your whole case here, but at least that gives you a little bit of information as to what it's all about.
Okay, and as opposed to using Evista, this is better?
So Evista is a medication that has some breast cancer prevention associated with it, which these others probably don't. There is some data that says you get less breast cancer, but it's really nothing that you would rely on. Evista as a medication for the treatment of osteoporosis is not statistically as as protective as some of the bisphosphonates, and there isn't quite as much fracture data out on that medication. Mm-hmm. So depending on what your case is and what your risk for fracture is, I hesitate to mention this while talking to you, but there is a score for that as well. We were talking about the Gale scale for breast cancer, but there's something called the FRAX score, F-R-A-X. I think I've mentioned it on previous shows. You can get it at the National Osteoporosis Foundation, NOF.org. And yet, it's a great thing, but it's not powered for people already on medicine. But you can go on there, and their website's great. You can read a lot about it. So if somebody is struggling with, do I start medicine? What do I do? It's a great score. It's a little bit less helpful for people already on medicine.
So bottom line, if I've had, as a result of taking Fosamax, if I have had acid reflux and quit taking the Fosamax, this may be a good alternative?
Oh, absolutely. Many people can tolerate it who were not able to tolerate the other bisphosphonates.
Thank you.
Very good. We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Dr. Suzanne Truppen. It's our regular show on women's health, and we'll have some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we're talking this morning about women's health. This is something that we do on a regular basis on the show. And it's one of a list of things that we know that people would always have questions about. So that's why we build it into the schedule in a predictable way so that you know on certain days at certain times we're going to have these guests. And then there are other things that we do, maybe not every month or every other month, but we do a pretty regularly for the same sort of reason. And we hope that this program is useful in the sense that you have a question, you have a problem, you can call, you can talk with somebody who has some expertise, and maybe you can get some help. Not always, but often. And it just amazes me the kind of work that I've seen guests here do where they're answering questions and giving out good information to people. So, you know, we've been doing this for a long time, and we hope that it's useful. And I know there are a lot of people have said, yeah, this is a regular thing to me. I'm a regular Focus listener. I meet people like that all the time, which is really nice. It puts a face on the audience. And now what I need to do, though, is say to people, well, I'm glad you listen, and I hope the program is useful, but I hope also you would be a supporter of this, not just this show, but of this station, which is what's happening when people call or go online and make a pledge. Here in studio with me, Amy Stewart Ray, we're talking with people and trying to get them to make that call or make that web pledge.
Absolutely. And to step up and to support the services and the programming that you value on WILL, you can do that by calling 217-244-9455. Or if you prefer, put your web browser at willpledge.org and make your pledge online. But it's important that we hear from you right now. I actually went back and did a quick count. I think that we are at 82 phone pledges for the day, and it looks like at about 50 web pledges. So 132 pledges so far today, which is a great start to a Monday. But we really want to sustain that momentum and keep encouraging our listeners to pick up that phone and call 217-244-9455 and make your pledge of support.
And we hope that you'll do that. As I said a little bit earlier, I know there are people who have been supporting the station for a very long time, and they're such great folks, and they are so loyal, and you know it's really wonderful for us, and we need to make sure we say thanks to those people. But for others who listen to the station and who are not supporters, you can't let those other people do it all. They can't do
no.
it all.
No.
And so that's why every time that we do this, and that's actually one of the reasons we do this, we go on the air because it's a way of reaching out to people who are listeners but not supporters and saying, look, we need you as well to be part of the whole thing.
Absolutely, to step up and become a part of the community that is the Friends of WILL, the people that step up and actively support, financially support the station, because they understand that to receive the programming they love, to get the NPR programming that they value, to get programs like Focus, which are expensive to produce, we need financial support from the members of our community.
And this is a rare thing. Not all stations could do this. And everybody can't have a locally produced talk show. And there are a lot of really good national talk shows. We run one of them, that we run On Point, a show that's produced in Boston, which is a great show. We run that at night. So that you can't call into that show. But here's an opportunity where you can, and I think that we have a lot of really fine national-level guests, the kind of people that you would hear on Fresh Air or On Point or many of the other national programs. And they're here accessible to our listeners.
Right,
that
to
is
our
the
community.
Coolest thing about it.
Absolutely. And then think about that. Think about the value of that. And that's something that really only WILL can provide you. Not only access to those type of guests, to authors, to journalists, to decision makers, but also the chance to ask your questions, to call up and participate in the discussion. There's something that that can't be replaced.
Yeah. Well, that's, we'll say one more time here, you can call 217-244-9455 and make a pledge. Real easy. Take about 2 minutes. Or if you'd like to do it online, you can. And I think more and more folks are doing that.
Absolutely.
Go to Will Pledge, W-I-L-L Pledge, just like it sounds, mm-hmm. willpledge.org. Hey, thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you, David.
This morning, guest in this hour of Focus is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist, has practice in our area, teaches at U of I Med School. And every other month she's here, we talk about women's health. Before we get away from the bisphosphonate conversation, I want to ask you about that because it has been in the news some lately. The FDA has been looking at these medicines, trying to ask this question. How long, that is, say, like for how many years can you say there's a benefit to taking it? And then there's at some point where you have to say, well, we're not so sure after, you know, 4 years, 5 years, however long. And they're looking at this. I think that they're talking about maybe rewriting the recommendations on this. So, I mean, what do you think in terms of how long there is a benefit?
So we realize that medications like Fosamax have a very, very long half-life. And that means that that compound will be incorporated into the bone and it will stay there into the bone. And that, secondly, that compound works by slowing down bone turnover. So if you don't wear your bone away, that bone stays thicker. And our goal is, and we always have to remember about the goal, our goal is to prevent fractures. And our goal is to treat the most high-risk people, the people that already have the most serious condition and actually do already have osteoporotic fractures. So what you want to do is maximize bone strength, and you want to figure out, what is your diagnosis and where are you on this whole process? So we've talked before about getting a bone density, and that talks about how thick your bone is, and that thickness will represent about 75% of your bone strength. So it's not just how thick your bone is, but it has to be thick and healthy. And in order to have healthy bone, of course, you need good nutrition, and we've covered that, but it has to have good structure. And those bone density tests will not determine bone structure. Bone biopsy will determine bone structure, but it's not a test that we can do. There are some pretty fancy CAT scans with lots of radiation exposure, but again, not generally a test that we will do. So we're maybe making some assumptions. Also, I find too many people with low bone mass that aren't getting treated with a bisphosphonate that haven't really properly had their complete picture assessed. They haven't been blood tested for secondary causes of osteoporosis. They haven't had a vertebral fracture part of the bone density test. Not all of our local machines are equipped to do that. So you want to get a real diagnosis. So so you want to be sure, what's your diagnosis and are your bones strong? And we want to prevent fractures. So to that end, we need to decide, okay, what's our best way to have strong bones? Well, get them strong to begin with and, you know, get the kids off some pop. Because the phosphorus to make those bubbles will bind calcium, and you have to accrue healthy bone mass as you grow up. And then also, eventually, aging process, we're going to wear bone down, so we're going to need some sort of treatment. And the easiest thing to do is slow down that turnover so not as much bone wears away on a daily basis, and so the bones will stay a little bit thicker. And that is what bisphosphonates are really good at doing. But ultimately, if your bones never turn over, they're not going to be as strong because their internal structure, that part that we can't measure, may not be as healthy. And because that internal structure is not as healthy, some people may develop abnormal fractures. So there's a balance between adding thickness and maintaining health. And whether that occurs, like you said, after a short time, maybe 5 years after a longer time, I have seen long-term data on the alendronate, the Fosamax, at 10 and 12 years, where for most people the structure is excellent still. And so it is a case by case. They're looking at what other factors might be considered if you need that drug holiday to get off. And like I said, some medicines stay in your bone a really long time. And the resendronate that's in the Actonel and the Ataliva actually has a much shorter half-life. It turns over faster, so that whatever drug holiday you would need would be probably a lot shorter. And maybe with that faster turnover may be different. So what is the real difference between some of these molecules? We don't have the complete answer to that either.
Okay. We have a caller, someone in Mahomet. So we'll talk with them on our line number one. Right here. Hello.
Yes. I would like to ask the doctor how she feels about these estrogen-progesterone blends that you take after menopause, and are they a good idea?
So I'm very supportive of hormone therapy in menopause for those who need it. So we've moved away from a strategy that we had many, many decades ago of literally treating everyone to a strategy of treating individuals who have problems to treat. So if you have what's called vasomotor symptoms, which is the medical term for hot flashes, or you have vaginal dryness, or you have other conditions that specifically can be treated by...
I don't have any of those conditions. I just, I'm 79.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to take some estrogen and progesterone because I took a lot of it through the years, way past menopause, and had very good results. My bones were good. My skin was good. I felt good. My breasts were good. And I had no side effects.
And are you somebody that's been off the therapy for a long time?
Been off what?
Have you been off your hormones for 5 to 10 years?
I had a bone density done in 1990, and he said, you have the bone densities of a 20-year-old. And I was on the estrogen progesterone at that time. Then they came along and said, no, 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 don't take the estrogen. It's got all kinds of bad side effects. But I'd been taking it for years with no bad side effects. Well, I stopped taking it then. But now they say that they can do a swab in your cheek or whatever and decide how much estrogen and progesterone you need. And I think that's a good idea. I wondered what you thought.
So a couple of things. Most of the recent research has shown that individuals who are off for a long stretch of time, much like what you're describing in your particular case, but it applies to many women, that once you have been off that amount of time, you go into a different category of therapy, and that there are significant complications to the therapy. And in many cases, you're not going to receive the benefits. And the current recommendation is that if you don't have a condition to treat, that we not use that therapy. Now, many women who are sexually active in their late 70s, early 80s do need a small amount of vaginal estrogen in order to be sexually active. And that's maybe a different situation because it's not something that is going to have systemic consequences. The the swab testing for hormone levels is not something that I endorse. I try to work with my patients that have spent their good money on those tests. There are no national labs. You can't get a swab test of your cheek at Mayo Clinic or Johns Hopkins or Harvard or the Quest Labs or the LabCorp, because saliva hormone testing, for the most part, for most of the hormones, is so unreliable relative to the blood testing. So if my patients want blood testing, then I think that if they want hormone testing, I think they should use something that is reliable as possible and endorsed by as many of the experts as possible. So that's the first thing. Secondly, if you're going to do a test, what you want to know is, how are you going to use the answers to that test? So that depending on what your condition is, maybe there are other treatments. So if you are fatigued, is estrogen at 80 going to change that? Not if there's no condition to treat. You said your skin was good. Well,
yeah, it's still
good. We've got you know, laser therapies and facials and antioxidants. There's many things that can make our skin much better than just hormone therapy will do.
I'm concerned about bone density, which my bone density is going down.
So, again, if you read the package insert, estrogen therapy is approved for treatment of osteoporosis in people who also need estrogen therapy or cannot tolerate other therapies. So if you are someone who cannot tolerate the other therapies, then you could consider estrogen therapy. But the Women's Health Initiative, the study that you were talking about, well, I guess you went off in the 90s, so I'm not sure. But the Women's Health Initiative has been the only study that showed hip fracture protection with estrogen. So that's one study, and it was done with Premarin. And so that the fracture protection is not going to be as strong as some of the other medicines.
Mm. That's what I took with Premarin. that doctor that's actually a psychologist, his wife said she had one of those, those swab tests, and that she's now on estrogen and progesterone, and she praises it regularly.
Again, estrogen and progesterone can be very effective strategies. And when you're menopausal and your ovary, which is the primary way our body makes estrogen, has stopped producing estrogen, you don't need a swab test to tell you that your body is not producing estrogen. So that's what I'm saying is, realistically, when we sit down, patient and doctor, what you want to figure out with your provider is, how is this test going to change what I'm going to do? And is this test worth me spending my money on, and why?
Yeah. Well, I don't have any problem with energy or anything else. Sex is fine. The only thing I'm concerned about is the bone density.
And again, I don't know your scores and that sort of thing, but you get a workup as to why your bone density is going down. And then there is a vast array of potential choices. Estrogen can be in the mix of those array. Only the medicine Forteo will actually bone build. So many people who are elderly and have very significant bone loss need to bone build, and they need to start with Forteo. So there are choices, and absolutely you should sit down with your provider and figure out what's going to be the best choice.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. I have one other that I want to try to include, and we're getting kind of short on time here. Someone who is in Urbana, I want to get to them, and this is on line number two right here. Hello.
Okay. What I wondered was, changing the subject quite a bit, when a young woman is overdue in her pregnancy by a week or so, what determines the physician's decision to induce labor? And then if labor has gone on a long time, at what point does a physician decide to do a cesarean?
So excellent questions. we have a due date, which is 40 weeks of pregnancy, and actually the first 2 weeks you're not pregnant, and the traditional definition of overdue has been at 42 weeks. And most physicians will start evaluating the pregnancy at around 40 weeks. And if the patient wants to wait and the evaluations like use of ultrasound to determine the amount of amniotic fluid and the use of fetal monitoring to determine some of the baby's heart rate considerations. If that's all healthy, many physicians will be willing to wait and watch until such time that any of the testing, and we're talking about a low-risk pregnancy, of course, and will be willing to watch until any of that testing changes. Most of the recent studies show that the complications of placental aging and potential consequence to the baby is about the same at 41 weeks and 42 weeks. So many of us will trend towards trying to encourage our patients to get delivered if they actually reach this 41-week stage rather than the 42-week. But that's individual, and it still varies, and it really highly depends on if mom's still healthy, baby's still healthy, based on surveillance. And then if we're going to do something about it, how are we going to do something about it? If the cervix is starting to soften and open, then the getting in there and getting that patient delivered might be an easier process than if we have to do something to the cervix to help that process go on. And there are really no fixed guidelines in how long labor should ensue to have a cesarean birth. It varies, and again, it depends on how healthy the baby is, how healthy the mom is, and what you think your statistical chances of success if you keep on going.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. There, we're going to have to leave it for this time around with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troop, and she's an obstetrician and a gynecologist, has practice in our area, teaches at the U of I Med School every other month. She's here, and we talk about women's health. And I think, actually, we're going to be seeing you next month.
I know. Our every other month got a little out of sync.
Well, that's good. I'm sure we'll have plenty of stuff to talk about.
We will.
Thank you. Thanks very much. A couple minutes here, we'll be going to the afternoon magazine. We have another opportunity here to suggest to people who are fans or regular listeners of Focus, and I meet people like that all the time who listen. If you're a big listener, and if you expect when you turn the radio on for Focus to be here, well, we hope that you're also a financial supporter of the station. That's something you can do any time, but particularly at this time, we remind folks how important that is. And Amy Stewart Ray is here with me in the studio to help us out with that.
Absolutely. Talk a little bit about our fall membership drive and let you know that as of this hour, I believe we've passed 600 pledges so far in this drive, which started on Friday, which is terrific. That's quite a turnout so far. And if you called in with your pledge of support, we say thank you very much. But if you've not called yet, if you are a WILL listener and a Focus fan and have not called in with a pledge, we would like you to do so now. Please call 217-244-9455, or you can go online to willpledge.org. Yeah,
our fiscal year starts on July 1st, and as we move through the year, we set benchmarks. We'd say, at this point, we'd like to have this much money, and at this point, we'd like to have this much money. So we really try to keep ourselves on track, and we've said for just in October, we hope this month we will raise $210,000, and what we're doing here this morning is part of that effort.
Yes, it's part of that larger overall October campaign, but certainly a very key component of it. And that is why I would like to urge you, anyone listening right now who has been a Focus listener for a long time, really values the information that you receive from this program, and you recognize that this is truly a gem of our community, something that no one else offers. Please step up and offer your financial support. Become a friend of WILL today. You can call 217-244-9455, and someone will be happy to take your pledge.
All right. That's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
And most physicians will start evaluating the pregnancy at around 40 weeks. And if the patient wants to wait and the evaluations like use of ultrasound to determine the amount of amniotic fluid and the use of fetal monitoring to determine some of the baby's heart rate considerations. If that's all healthy, many physicians will be willing to wait and watch until such time that any of the testing, and we're talking about a low-risk pregnancy, of course, and will be willing to watch until any of that testing changes. Most of the recent studies show that the complications of placental aging and potential consequence to the baby is about the same at 41 weeks and 42 weeks. So many of us will trend towards trying to encourage our patients to get delivered if they actually reach this 41-week stage rather than the 42-week. But that's individual, and it still varies, and it really highly depends on if mom's still healthy, baby's still healthy, based on surveillance. And then if we're going to do something about it, how are we going to do something about it? If the cervix is starting to soften and open, then the getting in there and getting that patient delivered might be an easier process than if we have to do something to the cervix to help that process go on. And there are really no fixed guidelines in how long labor should ensue to have a cesarean birth. It varies. And again, it depends on how healthy the baby is, how healthy the mom is, and what you think your statistical chances of success if you keep on going.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. There, we're going to have to leave it for this time around with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troop, and she's an obstetrician and a gynecologist, has practice in our area, teaches at the U of I Med School every other month. She's here, and we talk about women's health. And I think, actually, we're going to be seeing you next month.
I know. Our every other month got a little out of sync.
Well, that's good. I'm sure we'll have plenty of stuff to talk about.
We will.
Thank you. Thanks very much. A couple minutes here, we'll be going to the afternoon magazine. We have another opportunity here to suggest to people who are fans or regular listeners of Focus, and I meet people like that all the time who listen. If you're a big listener, and if you expect when you turn the radio on for Focus to be here, well, we hope that you're also a financial supporter of the station. That's something you can do any time, but particularly at this time, we remind folks how important that is. And Amy Stewart Ray is here with me in the studio to help us out with that.
Absolutely. Talk a little bit about our fall membership drive and let you know that as of this hour, I believe we've passed 600 pledges so far in this drive, which started on Friday, which is terrific. That's quite a turnout so far. And if you called in with your pledge of support, we say thank you very much. But if you've not called yet, if you are a WILL listener and a Focus fan and have not called in with a pledge, we would like you to do so now. Please call 217-244-9455, or you can go online to willpledge.org. Yeah,
our fiscal year starts on July 1st, and as we move through the year, we set benchmarks. We'd say, at this point, we'd like to have this much money, and at this point, we'd like to have this much money. So we really try to keep ourselves on track, and we've said for just in October, we hope this month we will raise $210,000, and what we're doing here this morning is part of that effort.
Yes, it's part of that larger overall October campaign, but certainly a very key component of it. And that is why I would like to urge you, anyone listening right now who has been a Focus listener for a long time, really values the information that you receive from this program, and you recognize that this is truly a gem of our community, something that no one else offers. Please step up and offer your financial support. Become a friend of WILL today. You can call 217-244-9455, and someone will be happy to take your pledge.
All right. That's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu.
Oh,
one minute before noon Central Time, 59 degrees in Urbana. In Kansas City, December wheat trading at 725 and three quarters, up 2 3/4. March, 738 and a half, up 1 3/4. December wheat in Chicago, 635 and a half, up 3 1/2. March, 670 and a quarter, up 4 1/2. December corn, 650 and three quarters, up 1 1/2. March, 662 and a quarter, up 2 1/4. May, 667 and a half, up 2. July, 671 and three quarters, up 1 3/4. November soybeans, 1222 and three quarters, up 10 1/2. January, 1231 and a quarter, up 10 1/2. March, 1239 and a half up 10, May 1246 up 10 and a half. December soybean meal 31910, that's up 260. The December soybean oil contract 5167 up 42. October live cattle 122.07 and a half up 15. The December contract unchanged at 122.15. November feeder cattle 142.42 and a half down 30. And December lean hogs 88.90 down 75. Outside markets, December crude 90.